Any questions about what we talked about this morning? Everything was clear, no doubts, no regrets. All right, so I want to keep going. So I want to talk a little bit about geodesics. If I find a chalk. And so we've talked about curves in space-time already, and the geodesic obviously is an example of a curve in space-time, but it's a curve with very special properties. And as you know, it's a curve that can be, well, it's actually a curve that can be defined in various ways, but the one that's probably the most relevant is the property that it's a curve that extremizes the distance between two points. And in flat space-time, we'd be talking about straight line between any two points. In curved space-time, well, it would be the appropriately curved path that would extremize the distance between two points. There are three types of geodesics in space-time because of that minus sign in the metric. We can have geodesics oriented mostly along time. Those would be mostly time-like, you know, those would be time-like geodesics, and those would correspond to the path of freely falling observers in space-time. Time-like geodesics typically are pretty interesting because that's, you know, the description of how bodies move if they're freely moving in space-time. There's a limited case of that where the bodies are moving with a speed of light that becomes a light-like geodesic or a null geodesic, and then there's the spatial paths, the spatial geodesics. And, you know, you can describe all of that in pretty much one package, but what I'll do here is to start with time-like geodesics. And I'll tell you something about the null case, and I won't say even anything about the space-like case because it's just more of the same. So we're going to be talking about a time-like geodesic. So it's going to be a time-like curve in space-time that, as its fundamental defining property, it's an extremum proper time between two events, between two points in space-time. And the important word here is the property of extremum, and I'm going to tell you in a second whether we're talking about a minimum or a maximum or whatever. So the picture is this. So we're given two events in space-time. I might as well call them A and B. Those two points can be linked by an infinite number of curves that would link the same starting point and the same endpoint, but we're interested in the one that would produce an extremum of the proper time interval between those two points. And what that means is that as we consider variations around that curve, we would find that, you know, a suitably defined proper time functional would be extremized along that true path, that geodesic path. So what do I mean by proper time? Well, proper time, so proper proper time in space-time is basically going to be just the, you know, the negative of the space-time interval, and we take the negative sign because here we have, you know, the dominance of the time direction versus the spatial direction. So we make everything positive by, you know, removing this minus sign. So it would be basically minus, you know, the metric acting on the coordinate displacements. That would be the proper time interval between two points or the square of that. So what I mean then is that, you know, proper time between A and B is going to be the integral of that between A and B. And that's what I mean by the proper time functional. It's actually a functional of the path, because when I evaluate this integral, I have to evaluate the metric along whatever selected path I've made, I've chosen, and I have to also evaluate the coordinate differentials along the path. So it's really a proper time functional, a functional of which path you pick when you go from A to B. And that's the, you know, that's the functional that we need to plug in into the you know, usual variational principle in order to get our equations of motion for the geodesic path. Now, usually the way it's done, of course, is to, well, first of all, I can reintroduce the parametric description of the curve the way we did it before. So I can express all the coordinate differentials, the coordinates on the path as a function of a parameter. And I can compensate for that by multiplying by d lambda outside the square root. So what we really have here is the metric expressed as a function of lambda along the path, and we construct the integral, evaluate the integral for each path, and then construct the extremum of that proper time functional. So the curve that produces this extremum is a geodesic between those two points. So here's a pop quiz. When I'm talking about extremum, am I talking about minimum or am I talking about a maximum? Who would care to make a guess or provide an answer? Oh, I heard something.
Maximum.
Is it a maximum? Who thinks it's a maximum? A small minority. Who thinks it should be a minimum? A small majority. And a few undecided. It's actually a maximum. So we're maximizing the proper time functional. Think of the twin paradox, right? If I don't do anything and I stay on Earth, I'm aging. If my twin is going off on a spacecraft moving rapidly near the speed of light and comes back, he's going to be much younger than I am when he returns. I'm following a geodesic. He's not. I'm aging more than he does. Therefore, I'm maximizing my proper time, whether it's in my best interest or not, when I'm moving on a geodesic. So it's really a maximum that we're looking for. It's actually a bit more subtle than that, and I was debating whether I would even mention it, but why not? That's an aside. It's a maximum for short separations. If you go beyond a certain separation of proper time, it turns out that the maximum turns into a saddle point. So what do I mean by that? So suppose that I've done the extremization of this, and I found the geodesic that links events A and events B and event B. What I really want to decide is whether that path, that curve, is really a curve of maximum proper time or something more subtle than that. I won't derive anything like this, and if you want derivations, you can either check out Wald's book or even worse, Hawking and Ellis. But here's how it goes. Once you've located the first geodesic, you can ask, well, what happens if I launch a nearby geodesic? And what happens if it happens to reconnect with my original geodesic along the way? So if you launch a nearby geodesic, well, there's a chance that it might actually never reconnect with the original geodesic, in which case the discussion is over. But there are cases where if you launch a nearby geodesic, and I'm talking about infinitesimally close, that it actually reconnect somewhere along the way with the original geodesic. So the statement is that this is a geodesic. The first one is a geodesic. This one is a nearby geodesic, but it's also a geodesic. And at that point over here, they reconnect, they converge, they reconverge. So that can happen. Certainly it happens on the surface of a sphere. You know, you can launch two geodesics from the South Pole, and they will reconverge toward the North Pole. So that's exactly the situation we're encountering here. That point here of reconnection, when you have infinitesimally close geodesics reconnecting like this, is called the conjugate point. It can be proved that at least to second order in the deviation between the two geodesics that proper time along the first geodesic and proper time along the second geodesic are equal. Well, that's just a fact. What it can also be proved is that proper time is actually a true maximum all the way up to C. That is, no word line linking A to any point below C on the word line will have a proper time that's any larger than the original geodesic. In that sense, before you hit the conjugate point, the geodesic is a true maximum of the proper time functional. No geodesic will have a longer proper, no curve, no world line will have a larger proper time. Beyond the conjugate point, you will find word lines that have a longer proper time. In fact, what you can do is to go along this guy for a while, and instead of reconverging here, you can go around the corner, you can smooth out and start following the other geodesic. And as you do that, as you just work yourself around C like this and reach B, you can construct a word line that this that's not a geodesic, but it's a word line that will have a longer proper time than this geodesic here as it goes from A to B. So the point is that here we have a maximum of proper time. Up to here, we still have an extremum. We haven't changed that. But the extremum, instead of being a maximum, has become a saddle point. So it's only a maximum in one direction, and it tends to be a minimum in other directions. Actually, it's the other way. So it's a maximum in two directions, but it's a minimum in the third direction. Well, we're talking about four-dimensional space-time here. So I'm not sure how many. I think it's, there's one direction that's going to be a minimum, and the other direction that's going to be a maximum. So it's really an extremum, a saddle point of the proper time functional. Anyway, I was debating whether I should go into that, but that's something that if you start reading about singularity theorems, if you go into Wald's book, you're going to see a lot of discussion of that, and it's sort of a cute property. There's a counter to that in purely classical mechanics. So when we do the principle of least action in Lagrangian mechanics, typically we expect the action for a mechanical system to define a minimum when we follow the true, the true path as dictated by Newton's equation. So the variation of the action functional for mechanical system tends to produce a minimum. Up to a certain point, it's not called a conjugate point in that context, it's called a kinetic focus. But then again, there's a situation where a true minimum basically switches over into a saddle point beyond a certain time in the evolution of the mechanical system. So it tends to be the rule that a maximum will turn into a saddle point, or a minimum will turn into a saddle point. So that's why people tend to insist that, well, we should really be talking about an extremum. In all cases, that is always a valid way of describing what's going on. Anyway, so that was just a little aside that I find myself interesting. Okay. Well, here's our proper time functional. And the proper time functional, well, that's something that, well, you know, variation, you know, extremization of a functional is something that we've all done before. It's really the starting point of Lagrangian mechanics. So anytime that you have something that looks like an integral, so tau is an integral of a Lagrangian over some parameter that we integrate over some parameter between two fixed points, then we make the usual requirements that we will consider variations around the true path that will begin and end at the same point. So we make sure that the variation vanishes at the two endpoints. So whenever we have a situation like this, we know that the extremum will be determined by plugging that into the Euler-Lagrange equations, which will take this form over here, where by dot, of course, I will mean dd lambda. And the point is that you plug your explicit Lagrangian here into the Euler-Lagrange equation, and that gives you the equation for the extremum, and the equation for the extremum therefore has to become the geodesic equation. So one way of deriving the geodesic equation is to follow through this procedure. I'm highly encouraging you to do that in your own time if you haven't done that already. I think it's a very educational exercise. You should do that. You might be surprised to learn that the outcome is not the usual way that you've seen the geodesic equation. It's actually a generalized form of that. The outcome of this looks like this. It's going to be obviously a second order differential equation. Sorry. The connection will occur because part of this operation will be to differentiate the metric, and that can be re-expressed in terms of the Christoffel symbols. You would expect the right-hand side to be zero if we're talking about the geodesic equation, but that's what I was driving at. The right-hand side is not equal to zero. The right-hand side is going to be equal to some quantity kappa, and we're going to be multiplying that by dx alpha d lambda. And kappa turns out to be, if you actually do the work, it turns out to be 1 over the Lagrangian times the derivative of Lagrangian with respect to lambda. And just to be clear, L turns out to be that square root that I defined. On the previous board. So that's really the outcome of the variational principle. And that, I claim, is the proper generalized way of describing the geodesic equation. And solutions, obviously, will describe geodesics. So what about the right-hand side? It's a bit unfamiliar. Usually, you would expect this to be zero. There are circumstances where it will be zero, but circumstances where it's not zero. And it turns out that in this course, we'll have a lot of occasions where the right-hand side is not going to be zero. So what's the deal with the right-hand side? Well, one property of the proper time functional that you may see right away is the fact that it really doesn't care on the identity of the parameter lambda. And in fact, that's an example of a functional that's parameterization invariant, reparameterization invariant. You can change lambda to any parameterization of the curve between A and B. And of course, you're not changing anything about the proper time interval between A and B. So you can change lambda into a function of lambda, and it doesn't change the value of the integral. You could see that right away because, you can see that just by the fact that the differentials here cancel out, in the way that I wrote down the integral originally, there was no reference to any parameterization. I introduced it, but the way I introduced it was completely arbitrary. Therefore, that's a functional that's reparameterization invariant. In particular, that means that there's nothing in this description that compels me to pick proper time itself as a parameter on the word line. Normally, that's what we do. When we describe the motion of an observer in space-time, that's what we do in special relativity. That's what we normally do in general relativity. We say we're going to parameterize the word line with the observer's own time. That's what proper time is. And that's what usually we would do. We would pick lambda to be proper time. And if we did that, well, we would pick a very special parameterization. We can do that. The point is that we don't have to do that. And if we choose not to do that, we end up with this more general way of writing down the geodesic equation. If we did choose to do that, if we did choose proper time as a parameter, we would find that the right-hand side actually vanishes because kappa vanishes in that case. So when lambda is selected to be proper time, that means that d lambda is equal to d tau. then the point is that the Lagrangian, which is, you know, now this instead of the usual thing becomes identically one. And that's easy to see because, you know, you just rewrite this as d tau squared, you just rewrite this as 1 over d tau squared, and you get something that obviously becomes 1. So the point is that when you pick the parameterization to be proper time, you are picking a very special parameterization that gives you a Lagrangian that numerically is equal to 1 everywhere on the geodesic. And if that's true, then the, you know, the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to lambda is guaranteed to be 0. And in those situations, of course, kappa is equal to 0. So again, when parameterization is given by proper time, then you recover the usual form of the geodesic equation with the 0 right-hand side. Well, there are lots of occasions in life where you may not want to do that. You may want to allow for more general parameterization than proper time, and I'll give you an example of that in just a couple of minutes. Turns out that this property that kappa can be set equal to 0 is not just you know, is not just something that happens when you pick proper time. In fact, what you can do is to rescale proper time by a constant factor and not change that property. So this property is preserved by all transformations where the parameter would be a rescaled version of proper time plus maybe a constant. And that's true because if you did that, if you were to rescale proper time by a constant, you would change the numerical value of the Lagrangian. It wouldn't be 1 anymore. It would be some constant value. But you're not changing the fact that the Lagrangian doesn't depend on the parameter itself. So it's a constant value on the whole world line. And therefore, you're not changing the fact that kappa is equal to 0. That class of parameters is called an affine parameter. It's called the affine class of parameters on the world line. So basically, any parameter on the world line that's constantly related to proper time and a constant, you know, shift is called an affine parameter. And for all affine parameters, then the geodesic equation is written with the 0 right-hand side. If you don't have an affine parameterization, if you pick something outside of that class, then typically there's going to be a non-zero right-hand side, and the right-hand side ends up being proportional to the tangent vector on the world line. Okay? So if you want to work through all the details of that, it's really just a matter of plugging the original Lagrangian into the Euler-Lagrange equations and just verifying that the right-hand side is indeed what I claim it is. All right? So that's something I would consider something that's a little bit new from what you've seen before, but I would like to actually point out the advantages of dealing with a non-affine parameterization. It may seem that proper time is always a good physical choice, and sure it is, but sometimes, and that's the point, sometimes it's more convenient mathematically to pick something else, and I'll show you an example of that in just a second. Just to complete the thought here, just to say that for affine parameters, the geodesic equation is the usual expression. All right, so anything puzzling here so far? Okay, let me show an example of why this is useful. And mostly in this course, it's going to be useful to not use an affine parameter for word lines when we consider null geodesics. And that's going to be especially true when we consider the generators of the event horizon when we talk about black holes. It turns out to be very convenient to use non-affine parameterization to describe how light rays behave on the event horizon. So that's the main motivation for talking about that here. But there are other contexts where this turns out to be an advantage. Another reason for talking about this is that in a few minutes, I'll talk about taking a limit for, a limit to null geodesics. So you can go from time-like geodesics to null geodesics by just, considering a limiting case where a particle starts moving faster and faster and eventually reaching the speed of light. And then you have the limiting case where the particle, moves with the speed of light. It turns out in order to think about carrying this limit, it's very inconvenient to do it with proper time because I'll come back to that in a second, but you can see it right away. If you're talking about a null geodesic, you're talking about a curve along which the spacetime spacetime interval goes to zero. And if the spacetime interval goes to zero, that means that the proper time parameterization along that word line becomes singular. So basically, the parameter doesn't advance as you move along the curve, because it's stuck at it's stuck at zero. So so proper time is a very bad parameterization if you consider taking a limit to a null geodesic, because the parameterization itself behaves badly as you take the limit. So I'll say a few more words a little bit later. So when you sort of start thinking about null geodesics in that limiting situation like this, it's very good to start from that more general point of view, where if you have a parameter that's very flexible, it really doesn't, worry too much when it's time to take the limit. Okay, so we'll come back to that in just a second, but let me say something about that that example that I promised you. So that's an example of non-affine parameterization. And the example is designed to emphasize the fact that sometimes it's more convenient to do it like that. So what we're going to do is to consider word lines in an expanding universe, so Friedman-Robinson-Walker metric. So I'm talking about the metric of an expanding universe that I'll write in the following form. So I have a scale factor that depends on time. And I have a spatial metric that I pick to be flat just because I don't want to complicate my life. So this is an example of a flat cosmology that expands. So the scale factor expands with time, and that's the metric of that expanding universe. So that's going to be the spacetime I'm going to be playing with, and I'm going to be talking about time-like geodesics in that spacetime. And by the way, I just have those results here. They may turn out to be useful. So if you calculate the Christoffel symbols for that metric, you find that the non-zero ones are given by those over here. So those ones are given by A dot over A. And those ones over here are given by A multiplying A dot. And the dot here means d dt. So the time coordinate here in this metric is the time that cosmological observers would use, so the proper time for cosmological observers. And what I mean by that is, well, basically all those observers that happen to be at rest relative to the cosmological fluid that's expanding, but you know, those are the observers that are just moving along with the expansion without having any proper motion inside the universe. And T, the time coordinate, is, you know, cosmic time. It's really the time for those observers. Okay. I want to describe time-like geodesics in that space-time, and an example of time-like geodesics in that space-time would be those cosmological observers that I just talked about. So if X and Y and Z are constant, and the observer is only moving along T, well, that's an example of a time-like geodesic. Okay, but that's boring. So what I'll consider here is an observer that happens to be moving with respect to the cosmological observer, and I'll pick that observer to be moving along X. So I'm going to be considering a time-like geodesics moving along the X direction. And what I'm going to do, and I think you can, well, see why I would want to do that, I'm going to pick the parameter along those geodesics to be T. T is not proper time for those observers that I'm talking about here. T is proper time only for the cosmological observers that are not moving with respect to the spatial coordinates. But I'm going to pick that T anyway, because T is sort of a favored, you know, well, it's one of the space-time coordinates to begin with. It's the coordinate in which I know what the scale factor is doing. And therefore, because it's already singled out in the metric in the setting that I'm giving here, it's sort of, you know, not a bad idea to decide that we're going to pick that time coordinate T as a parameter on this geodesic, even though that T is not going to be proper time along that geodesic, something that will be very clear very soon. So what's the parameterization of the geodesic? It's going to be that X alpha of T is going to be given by, of course, T. It's going to be given by what X of T happens to be. And then I'm going to assume that the particle is not moving, or that the word line is not moving along the Y and Z direction, but only along X. So basically what I would want to do is to find out what that function of X has to be in order for that word line to be a geodesic. I'm choosing T. So we pick the parameter to be T, but T is not proper time on this geodesic. Okay. We're going to see that in just a second. So I'm just going to let this go up. And there we are. Okay. Well, how do I find X of T? Well, typically you have to find out what its differential equation is, and then we'll see if we can solve that. But I'm not going to be bothered with finding solutions. So what do we do? Well, we can go through the procedure that we outlined over there. We just construct a Lagrangian and, you know, plug it through the Euler-Lagrange equations and see what we get. So the Lagrangian is, by definition, the square root of minus g alpha beta dx alpha dt, dx beta dt, because I've picked t to be the parameter. So we just plug in the metric we have upstairs. So it's simple, because the metric is nice and diagonal. So the first terms in the sum here will involve g0, 0, gtt, which happens to be 1, minus 1, cancel out the minus 1 over here. So, and then, of course, dtd is 1, dtdt is 1. So the first term inside the square root is just 1. And then we pick up a term coming from x. So we're going to have a negative sign coming from over here. Then we plug in gxx, which happens to be a squared. And that multiplies dx dt times dx dt, and that's x dot squared. And that's it, because there's no motion along y and there's no motion along z. So that's my Lagrangian for this proper time functional. And just the fact that this is not equal to 1 is already proof enough that my parameterization is not proper time. My parameterization is something else, right? So this property already guaranteed that t is not, you know, is not a proper time coordinate on the geodesic. It's not a proper time interval along the geodesic. So indeed, we are not dealing with proper time. Okay. So we go through the procedure of plugging that into the Euler-Lagrange equation. So what is it? Well, we get the d dt of dl dx dot has to be minus dl dx has to be 0. And now we recover one of those wonderful things of Lagrangian mechanics. We notice that, okay, this is something that depends on time, but there's nothing in here that depends on x explicitly. Therefore, this is 0. Therefore, this has to be a constant of the motion. So the momentum associated with the x coordinate in the sense of Lagrangian mechanics has to be a constant of the motion. So that's always a useful property. It's a property that often comes out when you're dealing with proper time and you have symmetries in your spacetime. Here, we have symmetries in the spacetime. We have the fact that the metric doesn't depend explicitly on any of its coordinates except time. But to exploit the symmetry, we don't need proper time as a parameter. That's something that follows for any parameterization on the word line. So let me just write this out. So so p, which would be dl dx dot, would be 1/2 times 1/2 over the square root, which is l, and then there's a minus sign. There's minus 2a squared over x dot times x dot. I'm going to call that minus p instead of plus p because I want to get rid of that minus sign. And what do I have? I have that p is equal to a squared x dot divided by the square root. So that tells me what the constant of the motion is in terms of everything else. But of course, what I really want to do with that is to solve for x dot, and that will give me the differential equation that x satisfies. So I think there's a couple of algebraic steps that I can skip here. I think you can all do that in your head, probably faster than me. So solve for x dot and get that x dot, I'm picking the positive solution here so that the particle is moving in the positive direction, is going to be given by that. And that's a very nice equation because if I plug in what my scale factor is supposed to be as a function of time, I can solve this equation by just evaluating an integral. It means that we've solved the problem by means of quadratures, right? I can write this as dx dt, put the dt on the right-hand side of the equation and integrate on both sides, and I have x explicitly given as an integral over t, and all I need to do is to plug in whatever function of, time A happens to be, and I plug that into the integral, evaluate the integral, and I'm done. So basically, the problem is solved as soon as you've written this differentiation. So it's a very nice, way of figuring out what the geodesic should be. So what's the point? The point is that if, that's the point of advertising for non-affine parameters. The next point I'm going to make, and just to bring this home, is that, this is a problem that finds a very simple solution very easily because we were wise to pick t as the affine parameter. As the parameter that happens not to be an affine parameter. If I had insisted all along to pick proper time as a parameter on the word line, Of course, I can still solve the problem. I mean, we're smart enough to do that. But there would be more complications involved. So let me just illustrate that briefly. Well, so let me approach this by asking this question. So what if, you know, after the fact, so now we've completely solved the problem. We know exactly what the geodesic is going to do because we know in principle how to solve this equation to give x of t, you know, completely explicitly. So that's the end of the problem as far as finding the geodesics. But what if we wanted more information? What if you asked me, well, you know, now that we know everything about the geodesic, how do we find proper time? Well, we can certainly find proper time after the fact from the results we have. How do we do that? Well, we just go back to definitions. So to calculate tau, we just go back to the fact that d tau dt is the Lagrangian, right? And what's the Lagrangian? It's 1 minus a squared x dot squared. And now that we know what x dot squared is, we just plug that in. And I'll skip the steps again. But that turns out to be a p squared plus a squared under the square root. Well, again, we find that, you know, by using t all along, not only we could find x very easily, but we can find proper time just as easily because, again, I can integrate for proper time by just throwing the dt on the right-hand side, plugging in whatever function of t a happens to be, evaluate the integral, and we're done. So we can reconstruct proper time just as easily as we could construct x of t. But let me go back to the previous question. So what if we had decided not to use t? And what if we had decided to use proper time instead? Well, if we had used proper time instead, we would have ended up with some work with an equation for dx d tau and another equation for dt d tau. So if we use tau as a parameter, then along the way, after doing a little bit of work, about the same amount of work, we would end up with an equation for dt d tau. And that I don't have to do a lot of work for. It's just given by what I have previously. And an equation for x d tau, which is, well, basically what I have over there divided by what I have over here. And let's see, do I write it down? Yes, it turns out that this is equal to p over a squared. Well, no big deal, you say. I can deal with that. But it's a little bit more tricky. Because on the right-hand side, a is expressed as a function of t, not as a function of proper time. So the ease with which we could integrate before, because we were using t, and t is contained in A, we don't have it anymore. Of course, it's not, you know, it's not an ultimate obstacle. I mean, we can still deal with that. We can still integrate those differential equations. The point is that it's much easier to do it and much more straightforward to do it if you're doing it in the first way and using t as a parameter than if you were to do it using proper time as a parameter. So that's the only point that I really wanted to make, is that those are more difficult to integrate because A is known as a function of T, not tau. And in order to obtain solutions to that, well, you have to do a lot more work than just evaluate integrals very straightforwardly. So this would be an example where, you know, because T is sort of singled out already in the metric, it may actually be a good idea to stick with T as a parameter and forget about, you know, using affine parameters in the way that you would normally be, you know, compelled to based on your previous experience. That's just an example. There'll be others like that, other reasons to do something to do something similar. Any questions about that? Okay, let me do one more thing based on this example to go back to something I was talking about just before. Like, I'll stay right here. I was trying to. Still learning how to operate the boards and be clever about it, so. So what if instead of time like geodesic, I wanted to consider a null geodesic moving in that space-time? Well, we ought to be able to find a null geodesic by doing what I was, you know, thinking about before. You just take a limit where the particle moves faster and faster, and then you take the limit all the way, and you have, you know, the particle moving with the speed of light. Well, what do we have to do in order to take that limit? Any suggestions? In fact, I'll go over here because I think it's going to be much easier to find a way to take the limit if we think about those equations over here. And that's also part of my story. So I want to take a limit where the particle moves faster and faster. How do I do that? Do I have a quantity I can tweak? P? P is a constant, right? So P can take whatever value I want it to take. If P is zero, of course, my particle is not moving at all. So where do I need to take P in order to get a null limit? Did I hear infinity? That's right. If I take the limit where P goes to infinity, I'm reaching the null case. How do I see that? In fact, I'll come back here because here's my expression for the Lagrangian. We know that the null case occurs where when the Lagrangian goes to zero, because that's when the space-time interval between two points on the word line goes to zero. If I want the Lagrangian to be zero, and I'm tweaking P, of course, the only option I have is to take P all the way to infinity. So we can see it right here, and we can see what this produces over there. So the null limit, take P all the way to infinity, therefore making L equal to zero. And if we do that, we get that the equation for dx dt becomes so I have to be careful, but you know, when P goes to infinity, this dominates over that. This P will cancel out that P, and x dot will become 1 over a. And that's something that's even easier to integrate than what we had before. So taking the null case when we use T as a parameter is dead easy. No complications whatsoever. Success. What if we use proper time? Well, what happens to this when you take P to infinity? It goes nuts. And this goes nuts also when you take P to infinity, and that's because, well, proper time is just bad. Proper time is a bad parameterization when you consider taking a limit like that. Proper time is fine as long as you stay well within the speed of light, but if you, you know, consider taking a limiting case like this, it's really a bad way to get started because, you know, this going nuts and this going nuts is just a statement that in the limit, proper time is a bad parameter, because as you start taking a limit, delta tau becomes smaller and smaller on the curve. So if you have a sequence of geodesics, say, you know, we're going in T and X. So let's say the first one goes like this, and then, well, let me pretend I'm in flat space here because that doesn't matter for the point. So this is V equals zero, this is V equals something, this is V equals something else, and this would be the limiting case. This would be almost, you know, V equals one. On this word line, of course, proper time is exactly equal to coordinate time, so the spacing here is nice and uniform. So this would be tau equals 1, tau equals 2, tau equals 3. On this one, the proper time interval would start to shrink a little bit, because now proper time becomes the square root of 1 minus v squared times dt. So now, because v is, you know, say v is equal to a third, v is equal to 2/3, v is equal to, you know, 0.99. Here, the interval between ticks of proper time becomes a little bit shorter. So this is tau equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then on this one, it becomes, you know, tighter still. On this one, it basically all accumulates down here. And basically, ticks of proper time are all jammed together. Because proper time becomes almost zero, you know, changes by almost zero from, you know, from this point to that point on the word line. And then in limit, of course, it all shrinks down to a single point, and the parameterization just goes badly singular. So nothing very deep about this, but it's good to think about that, and it's good to think about, you know, advantages of using parameters that are not proper time in order to fix problems like that. And sometimes it's very desirable to say, approach null geodesics as limiting cases of time-like geodesics. And when you do that, though, you have to be a little bit careful with the choice of parameterization. And that was an example. Any questions about that? Okay. One fact you may not know, or you may not have encountered before. That's the geodesic equation for a moving particle in an expanding universe. So if you're an observer in the universe and you happen to be moving relative to the cosmological fluid, well, your motion is going to be damped by the expansion of the universe. In fact, the larger the universe becomes, the less you're going to be able to move, because you're moving with fixed momentum p. And as the universe keeps on expanding, you're going to find that while that proper motion of the observer goes slower and slower, and eventually, basically, you have cosmological damping winning over your motion, so you're going to be damped to zero velocity. So that plays a role in cosmology, actually. I mean, there are all sorts of mechanisms that produce damping in cosmological processes in the early universe, and it's basically all a manifestation of that, that if you're moving one way or another with respect to the cosmological observers, that motion will be damped by the very expansion of the universe. Yep, question? In this context here, well, I was sort of, I was assuming that in just the providing context, but there's nothing here. Well, For what I'm talking about here, of course, it's important. If A was decreasing, it would be the exact opposite conclusion. But for all the mathematics that I'm doing here, there's no requirement that A be increasing. In fact, A is any function of time, and it doesn't matter what it does. Okay? In the book, I tell you a couple of more things about this. I tell you that if you're given a geodesic with any parameterization on it, it's always possible after the fact to reconstruct an affine parameterization on that geodesic. It's possible in the time-like case, and it's possible also in the null case, and I give you the recipe for that in the book, so that's something that you can read about. something that we'll probably come back to at some point in the course, but I don't think I want to spend time on that right away, right now. So I'm about done with this, and I'm going to be moving on. So any more questions on that? Anyway, I find that this is a pretty instructive example, and I find that to be a fairly convincing case for why sometimes it's useful to build in more generality into the description of the geodesic equation. Something I didn't do in this example that probably you should do for completion, and when I say that, I mean it, you should really do that, you know, after we're done today, you go home and you do that, is to actually compute kappa for this particular example. I've given you L over here, and we know that kappa is, 1 over L times dL dt in this case, so you can actually calculate kappa explicitly in this example and figure out what it is. I think it's a couple of extra steps, and it's sort of instructive to see what it turns out to be. Okay, so nothing more to say about any of this? Okay. Let me move on to the next topic, and here we're going to talk about Lie differentiation. So just out of curiosity, so who's encountered Lie differentiation before? Oh, almost everybody. Who has not? Lie derivatives. Who's familiar with Lie derivatives? Who's not? No, you all raise your hand. So who's not familiar with Lie derivatives? Don't be shy. We're here for that. Okay, so because there's really a strong majority here who's encountered Lie derivatives before, I'll say very little about it. I'll just consider that to be a refresher point, as I did this morning. So Lie was a famous French mathematician, and I suppose he invented that, along with Lie brackets and Lie groups and Lie algebra and all sorts of things. What's the point of Lie derivatives? Well, it turns out that it's a very important notion of derivatives in space-time for two reasons. One is that it's actually a way of doing tensorial derivatives without needing a connection. So it's a rather primitive and robust notion of derivatives that does not require this extra structure that we had to introduce this morning in order to define covariant differentiation. So you don't need a connection to differentiate if you're using Lie derivatives. The other reason why it's useful for us in GR is that it's really the notion that carries the idea that a certain tensor is invariant if you take it from one point to another point. So what we want to express in a covariant way, in a way that's geometrically meaningful, is the notion, for example, in Schwarzschild spacetime, we have a metric that happens to be independent of t. What that means is that we take the metric at one time and we propagate it to some other time, and the metric doesn't change when we do that. Well, the way to convey this information in geometrical terms, in a nice way, is to say that the Lie derivative of the metric along the time direction vanishes. So it's a fancy way of saying something simple like, there's no time dependence in the metric. That would apply to the metric, but of course that would apply to other tensors as well. So what's the idea? Well, let me just write down what the Lie derivative of a vector would be. The notation is that you have a curly L, and you have an index here that describes the direction in which you carry the Lie derivative, and you're acting with this differential operator on a vector that's defined somewhere. And the definition of that, or, well, actually what it is, I won't use the sign definition because it's really the outcome of the definition, is that first you differentiate the vector in the direction of the vector u, and from that you subtract the derivative of u in the direction of the vector. And if you have good eyes, you're going to notice that this would be the same thing as the lead derivative of A of u with respect to, would be minus the lead derivative of u with respect to A. So the lead derivative is closely tied to the Lie bracket, which is antisymmetric in this way. Now, the claim is that this is covariant. Even though we're using partial derivatives on vector components, which is really a sign of warning, turns out that this by itself certainly does not transform as a vector. This by itself does not transform as a vector because we're using partial derivatives here, not covariant derivatives. But because we have a minus sign, you find that the problems associated with each term individually, when you look at their tensorial transformation, cancel out. And in fact, the combination with the minus sign produces something that has a very nice transformation property, under a coordinate transformation. And this is really a vector, even though it doesn't look like it when you look at it on the right-hand side. And you have to do some extra work to convince yourself that the right-hand side is really a tensor. So the point is that we have a tensorial notion of differentiation on, well, vectors or tensors that requires no connection. And that makes it useful. To begin with, and it makes it remarkable also. Well, what's the meaning of this? Turns out the meaning is pretty intricate, and it's kind of interesting, and it's kind of useful to think about what it really means geometrically, what we're doing here. So I'll send this upstairs. Well, I'll draw a picture, but I have to be very careful when I draw the picture, because everything is in the picture, and if I get it wrong, I'll get it wrong. So I'm going it without notes, as opposed to laugh here. Okay, so we have two vectors, two vector fields, A and U. And I'm going to be thinking very carefully about those vector fields as being tangent to curves in my manifold. So let me start with u. In this argument and in the expression for the Lie derivative, you can see right away that it's very important for u to be defined globally in an open region, because I'm saying here that I'm going to be differentiating it with respect to all sorts of directions, even though ultimately I'm only interested in the derivative along A. But to get started, I really need to define u as a vector field in some open region on a manifold. If I have u defined in an open region, and I'm thinking of u as being everywhere tangent to curves, what I'm saying here is that in that open region, I have a whole network of curves that are going to be everywhere tangent to u. So that's what I want to start drawing. So we have curves tangent to u, and here's going to be one of them. Here's going to be another one. Here's going to be another one. And I'll draw a fourth one, and that's going to be good enough. So those are the curves to which u is tangent. So I can draw u over here. I could draw u up here. I could draw u over here. And so on and so forth. So I have u everywhere there, and I have, you know, tangent curves everywhere also. When I look at the expression above, I can see that A only has to be defined along one curve. Because when I, you know, when I take the derivative of A here, I only care about its derivative along any one of those curves, but I could care about only its derivative along one of the curves. That's not a very important point. We could also define A to be defined everywhere, but I'll pretend here that it's defined only on this first curve. So A would be, for example, A would be looking like this over here, and it would be looking like this over there, and it's looking like, you know, whatever it wants to look like anywhere else on the curve. Okay, let me call this point P, and I'll call this point Q. And now I'll do something. So what I want to do is to differentiate E in the Lie sense at P. But I know that what I cannot do is to compare A at P with A at Q, because, you know, those are different points. I cannot do that, right? So I have to be doing something else. I have to do something geometrical, something that's well-defined on manifolds. Well, let me continue with the construction, and I'll describe what I do. It's going to look crazy. Well, it's not crazy. It's going to look like, you know, something a little bit unusual, but the point is that it works. It's a well-defined operation, and it's a well-defined operation that leads to this definition or this outcome for the Lie derivative. Okay. A is defined here. Remember, I'm thinking about vectors as being tangent to curves. I've talked about the integral curves of u so far. Now I'm going to, you know, I'm going to introduce a curve that's going to be tangent to A at that point. Here it is. The curve has to start here, go through here. It has to be tangent to A at that point. Beyond that, I really don't care what it does. The first curve that I drew here is going to be parameterized in some way. So this is going to be lambda, P is going to be at lambda equals 1. And let's say that Q is going to be at lambda equals 1 plus delta lambda. So I'm thinking of those two points as being close together, infinitesimally close. I've picked a parameterization on this curve only so far. I'm free to pick the parameterization on every other curve in any way that I want. What I'm going to do is to use this curve here, this cross curve that I just drew that was designed to be you know, tangent to A. I'm going to pick this curve to fix the parameterization here to be lambda equals 1, lambda equals 1, lambda equals 1. I can do that, nothing prevents me from doing that. By picking the parameterization, I really mean picking the first, you know, the starting value for the parameter at the chosen point. Because the rate at which lambda changes on the curve is not free, it's dictated by u, right? U is everywhere over here related to, you know, the curve by this expression over here. So the rate at which lambda changes along the curve is fixed. What is not fixed is what value I assign for lambda here, here, and here. And what I've told you here is that I've actually fixed that. I've assigned that. Okay. The next thing I'm going to do is to slide this curve by d lambda throughout. So I'm going to take this point, I'm going to raise it by d lambda, and I'm back at Q. I'm going to take this point, and I'm going to raise it over here by d lambda, and I'm going to be here. I'm going to take this point, raise it by d lambda, and I'm going to be here, and then this one over here. So this is all lambda equals 1 plus d lambda, lambda equals 1 plus d lambda, and so on. So the whole curve is raised by d lambda, and I get that curve over here. I should draw it in dash. So it doesn't look like a very smooth curve, but that's fine. So that's the raised curve. That's rigidly tied to the first curve by, you know, raising up by an amount d lambda. A at q is not tangent to that new curve. There would be no reason to expect A to be tangent to that new curve. There's going to be a tangent to that new curve, which is going to be that vector over here. And let me call that vector A prime. There's no reason for A prime to be anywhere near A, to be equal to A. There's no reason for A to be tangent to the new curve. But look what I have now. I have two vectors at that point that I can compare. So what's the definition for the Lie derivative? The real definition for the Lie derivative of A evaluated at P is that you take, you take the original vector at Q, you subtract the constructed vector at Q that we just constructed, you divide by d lambda, of course you take the limit where d lambda goes to zero, and you call that a derivative. And you say that this is the derivative of A, the Lie derivative of A at P. Even though everything is done at Q, you call that the Lie derivative at P. This very sort of laborious construction that I went through is perfectly well defined. It's perfectly, you know, geometrical. It gives us a means to construct a different vector at Q that can be compared with the original vector at Q. And that's what we needed in order to construct a derivative operator, in order to construct this new way of differentiating vectors without needing to introduce a connection. I find it pretty nice. I mean, it's not intuitive. It's not, you know, necessarily something you would do, but you can do it, and it works. I've given you the definition. Of course, you have to do a little bit more work to show that this actually reduces to what I have up there. I'll leave that for you as a challenge. In the book, I actually do it, but in a different way. So I don't carry this out in the book. But I think I'll leave it to you as a challenge that this reproduces the expression above. And the way to do it is to basically, carry out Taylor expansions where you take everything that's at Q and you Taylor expand about P as, you know, just straightforward mathematical operations. There's a bit more to it than that, but, you know, it's essentially that. And when you're done, you end up with that expression up there. There is nothing here. The construction that I'm displaying here, is really something you would do for vectors. I should tell you something about how to extend this to one-forms and other tensors. But basically, the way to do that is to just, you know, postulate that the Lie derivative is something that should obey the product rule of differential calculus. So all derivative operators are typically required to obey the product rule. And then the other one is that the Lie derivative acting on the scalar should be the usual thing as the partial derivative. So acting on a scalar is the same thing as doing ordinary differentiations. So that's something I talk about in the book, so you can follow that part of it in the book. I won't dwell on that here. But the construction that I displayed here is really the way to define Lie differentiation on a vector. So you had a question? I saw you first.
Does this vector A prime at all approximate, like if you had a connection and you parallel transported A along, what's our line here called, U, does this A prime at all approximate the actual parallel transport, or is it completely unrelated?
It's unrelated. In fact, so parallel transport would be use. So to parallel transport A up to here would be something you would do if you were a geodesic, if that curve was a geodesic. If you didn't have a geodesic, there would be no particular reason to parallel transport a vector along it. You can still do it, but there's no particular reason for that. So the construction really gives you something that's not a parallel transport version of A. It's something else. It's just something else. And you could work out the difference. The difference obviously wouldn't involve the connection, right?
Yeah.
You had a question?
Can you just recap how you got A at Q from A at B? I didn't quite catch that.
Which one? This one?
Yes.
Okay. So here I'm just assuming that so we're given two vector fields, U and A. So I tried to make a small point about the fact that A only had to be defined on this curve, but that's really not important. The point is that U being defined everywhere told us how to construct those curves, because they're the integral curves of U everywhere.
Maybe that's what I confused now. A was initially defined all the way along that curve, and so A at Q is not the same as A at P, but
so the vector field is defined everywhere, so it's defined at P, and here it is. It's defined at Q, and here it is, and that's all there is.
Yeah.
Is that clear? Yeah. Other questions? Yep.
I'm just confused. The line where you show us say that you, I think it's when you introduce your parameter of the curves.
Yeah.
I'm confused about that.
You're confused. Okay, so when I started to talk about lambda equals 1?
More the equation U alpha is equal to dx alpha over d lambda.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, I wasn't very clear about that. Okay. When we go from a vector field to integral curves, we have to introduce a parameterization. So if we're given U and we don't worry about the integral curves, then that's fine. We don't have to relate U to any lambda or anything like that. So U is just given as a vector field. But if we go from the vector field to integral curves, then basically the mathematical operation is to say so U is a vector field. The integral curves are going to be the curves that are everywhere tangent to U. And in order to construct those curves, well, we say let's describe the curves in terms of a parametric description. And let's demand that the tangent to the curves match the vector field. That's the mathematical procedure that allows you to start from a vector field and construct those integral curves by solving the system of differential equations. And then on top of that, well, you make sure that the integral curves, start at, it's a system of first order differential equations. So if you provide the starting position, then there's a unique solution for any curve. So if you start here, then the whole curve is defined. If you start here, the whole curve is defined. And then you start from all possible starting locations and you generate the whole network of curves. And that's basically how you generate something like that. So that's what I didn't say before. But basically, once you've done that, once you've introduced the integral curves, then you have, you have this equation holding everywhere. And basically, by picking the parameterization, at least in the sense of having picked the rate at which lambda varies along the curve, you've pretty much done everything except to pick which value lambda should be here or here or here. So basically, when you integrate the equations, you can pick the initial value of lambda to be anything you want, and you can slide it to make sure that that you have the lambda equals 1 property holding where you want it to hold. Is that clear?
Yeah. Each curve is a solution to the differential equation with different initial value.
That's right. So you pick the initial value for x, but you can also pick the starting value for lambda.
And then we care about comparing an infinitesimal shift in each of the
In each of those points. So having agreed that lambda is going to be equal to 1 everywhere here, then we just shift it all by the same amount, d lambda, and then we end up with this new curve, this new vector, and all that. All right. Any other clarifications required? Okay. So basically, the idea of Lie derivatives is that you first do it for vectors, and then you generalize it for one-forms and tensors by just imposing those additional properties, and then you have a notion of Lie derivatives for everything you want. So just to complete that before we quit. So for a vector, we had it before, the Lie derivative of a vector along U is the derivative of A with respect to U minus the derivative of U with respect to A, like that. If you're differentiating a one form, I wouldn't want to get this wrong. Yeah, it's on page 7. So first you differentiate the one form with respect to U, but then here there's a plus sign. And the indices work like that. And again, this is tensorial, and everything is nice. If you're dealing with, so this is for a dual vector. If you're dealing with a tensor, so for example, something that would have two indices, one up, one down, well, then you just keep adding terms like that with appropriate choice of signs. And then, so you would get, for example, the derivative of the tensor with respect to U, then you have the derivative of U with a minus sign, and then you have the other derivative with the plus sign. And then, maybe I'll consider another example. If you have a Lie derivative of U and a tensor that has two indices down, then what you would do is to take derivatives with respect to U, and then there would be two terms with a positive sign. There would be a U gamma comma alpha multiplying V gamma beta, and then there would be U gamma beta multiplying V alpha gamma. And then, you know, if we were to do this with tensors with more indices, there would be more terms, and depending on the placement of indices, there would be either plus or minus signs, and we can continue this, you know, in any number of ways. And the basis for all of that is what I described before. You just make sure that the derivative operator satisfies the product rule and satisfies, it's basically just the product rule and the requirement that, well, I might as well write it down. So for a scalar, you have that the Lie derivative acting on a scalar function is just the partial derivative of that function along the vector U. All right, let me just say one more thing. And that's coming back to the example I gave before. So suppose I want to say that a vector A does not depend on some coordinate, let's say x0, t. Well, one way of saying this, of course, is to say that the partial derivative of x alpha in the coordinate system is equal to zero. And that's perfectly fine, but now we have a statement that's really tied to a very specific coordinate system, and that's the type of thing that people don't like. They want to have this written in a way that would be coordinate invariant. Instead of saying that, we can say, well, okay, in our spacetime, we have a bunch of preferred curves, you know, the curves of, you know, along which t increases. So here are so the meaning of this, of course, is that we have a bunch of curves along which t increases. And as we take the vector from point to point on each curve along which t increases, it doesn't change. That's the meaning of that statement, right? So those are the curves xj equals constant along which x naught changes. And if we have this whole bunch of curves, well, we know we have a tangent vector field on each curve that points in that direction, and I might as well call it u, and u just turns out to be in this coordinate system given by one and a bunch of zeros, right? Because the vector changes only if I change the time direction, if I go along the time direction. And that's what it means here. I have only a one entry along the zeroth direction and zero entries everywhere else. So that's valid in a particular coordinate system. So I like to indicate this with a star. That's valid in any, in the same coordinate system. So I like to indicate that with a star. But the point is that the vector field, you know, exists in whatever coordinate system, and this vector field also exists in whatever coordinate system. It just happens to be simple in this particular coordinate system. One property of this is that in the adopted coordinates, this happens to be zero, right? Because the vector is constant in this coordinate system, therefore all its partial derivatives are constant, are zero in that coordinate system. And then this statement I can rewrite as saying that A alpha in the direction of u happens to vanish. And that's also something that's valid in the coordinate system. All right. So far we haven't done anything except to rewrite a bunch, you know, write a bunch of things that are just all saying the same thing. But now here's the point. The Lie derivative of A, well, I won't put it in a coordinate system because we know that this is a covariant thing. The Lie derivative of A in any coordinate system is what we know it is. And what we see is that in the adopted coordinate system, this happens to vanish, this happens to vanish. Separately, these would not be statements that would be valid in other coordinate systems. Those would not be separately covariant statements. But when we take the combination with the minus sign, we are constructing something which is independent of the coordinate system. So what do we have? We have the statement that this is zero in the adopted coordinates. But because it's a tensorial equation, if I have a tensor that's zero in one coordinate system, it's always going to be zero in any coordinate system. So what do we have? We have the statement that the Lie derivative of A is equal to zero in any coordinate system. And what that means is that what I was trying to say here in coordinate language has a tensorial equivalent, and the tensorial equivalent is really involving the Lie derivative. So Lie derivatives are used in GR when we want to say something like this, when we want to say something like a vector is independent of translations in spacetime, when it doesn't matter, if I have a curve and I translate the vector field along that curve and it doesn't change, you know, I can say that this means that, you know, there's an invariance of the vector along a coordinate shift along that curve, and I'm right, but I'm restricted myself to, you know, I've said something that really refers to a very specific coordinate system. If I say instead that the Lie derivative of that vector vanishes along the vector field tangent to the curve, I'm saying same thing. I'm saying the same thing, but now I'm saying it covariantly, meaningfully, in a way that's, you know, valid geometrically in any coordinate system. So that's why Lie derivatives are important, because they allow us to carry to express these things formally in a better way. What I'll do next time is to take this idea to the metric, and then we'll have a, you know, we'll have our killing fields that express invariants of the metric under translations in spacetime. All right, that's all I had for today. So any questions before we go home and eat? Okay, so we'll stop here and I'll see you next time.